Talking Cows Podcast, Episode 32.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Hey everybody, it's Clay Conner here, Working Cows Podcast host, just sitting down with another interview for you. Had a couple of issues this week. I fought and fought and fought to get my Steve Kenyon and my Kathy both interviews up to snuff, but we just couldn't quite do it. So we will have to try and reschedule with them and get those out to you at a later date. But Todd Bozen stepped in for me. Todd Bozen has been working on a project called Graze 365, where he's trying to graze year-round with some cows out there in South Central South Dakota. And I called Todd up, and he was willing to pinch hit for me and step in on short notice, so I really appreciate that. And I will get you right into this interview with Todd Bozen of Kimball, South Dakota. Todd, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast. I'd like to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself, just share a little bit about yourself and your story and kind of where you're at and what you're up to.
Hey, thanks for having me, Clay. I'm out here in, I guess they call it South Central South Dakota, rural county, Kimball, Chamberlain area. Fourth generation farmer rancher out here. I've ran about 400 to 500 cow calf head operation when my father and uncle were running it steady. I since switched it up to more or less just cow calf instead of a full finishing operation like we used to have, just coming down to more logistics of labor and time and everything like that that I didn't have so much of anymore. I kind of got a crazy notion to do with the lacking of labor, trying to figure out where I could cut some costs at and time and everything. I got to looking online and visiting with a bunch of people and run across Jim Gresh and his Kicking the Hay Habit book I read and his big grazing one, and kind of intrigued me on seeing if I could actually make something like that work here where South Dakota, we still get a fairly blustery winter and not a whole lot of grazing through the deal. And one of the keys to his book is kind of making sure you stock your ranch according to what you can hold through the winter, not necessarily just in the summer. So we kind of took that to note and kind of cut our herd back a little bit. We kind of took the opportunity to call down some of the larger cows out of the operation and some of the older ones and things like that too. So we managed to make 1 year on one group of cows, about a year and a half to three quarters on one group of cows, and we never fed them actually one bale of hay through that whole duration, and was kind of going to be our model going into transitioning the whole group that way. And unfortunately, our drought this last season kind of proved a little more bothersome than I think we were all anticipating, and we ended up having to break down and start feeding hay about February to most of the cattle. So.
Yeah, no, I don't think you were alone in that by any stretch of the imagination. It was kind of a rough winter and a rough in through the spring with some snow cover more than anything. But what do you think was the biggest key to you? You started a hashtag. I came across your hashtag on Twitter, Graze365. What do you think was the biggest key to the success thus far in just reducing the amount of hay that they are eating? What was the main thing that was required to make that a reality?
I think the two biggest things I think I did was we got rid of the larger cows that consume way more grass for their output was, I'll say, was for sure one. And then we implemented a pretty intense rotational grazing system, broke a lot of the pastures down. I had some pastures that were full sections, and we broke them down into 100-acre paddocks, and moving cows through them more frequently, giving the grass more rest, and leaving more out there, I'm sure, gave us a little bit of an edge, especially I noticed over the neighbors. We reduced the stocking rate. Like I said, we were pushing 500 head beforehand. We're down to about 350 right now, and I'm going to work my way back up because we're still probably a little understocked, but I'm kind of going with the premise of let's be a little pessimistic on it and try to work our way back to where our maximum is going to be. So to kind of supplement the flux in cattle numbers, we were taking in from custom grazing pairs during the peak draft season. And I kind of like that because then I can cut them loose and we manage them cows in our system the way we manage our own cows. So that way I know my grass is getting treated the way I want it to be treated.
Yeah. No, that's really good perspective, you know, and I think that in custom grazing, I think a lot of people call it their safety valve, is such a huge part of this managing grass for the ability to graze 365 days a year. You know, it seems like everybody I talk to that's doing it is using custom grazing as part of that strategy.
Well, I think a guy has to just because in your springtime, you got a lot of cool season grass coming, and you've got to use it up. You've got to get it ate down so you give the warm seasons a chance to come in. The warm seasons are a better, hardier grass to winter your cattle on versus the cool seasons. So, I mean, that's kind of why we use it that way. Obviously, you're not going to run the same amount of cows in the winter as you can in the summer. So that's kind of why I like the taking the grazing cattle on, because then we can dictate, you know, drought or whatever else. We can still cut them loose sooner if we have to and not necessarily have to call back on numbers, which I know some people have this last drought year. There was a lot of people in the neighborhood that called cows or started feeding in the middle of the summer and sat there and looked at us and go, God, why aren't you using that pasture across the fence from them? And I'm like, I'm saving it for later. I don't need to run in it now, and I don't want to run in it now. I'm rather in our infancy when it comes to this rotational grazing and the grazing 365. I took one herd and made it bigger and pushed it through and made it 365 days and said, well, hey, this was our good base model. We go into 17 and a drought starts, and all of a sudden products that we ran 5 days the year previous were now down to three, maybe even two.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as the summer progressed, I watched grass disappear faster than it came and not even ran cows on it. So
what were some of the things that you were looking at as far as how you choose your paddocks? You mentioned cool and warm season grasses. You know, where were you going to figure out what grasses were best? How'd you come up with that information?
Well, unfortunately, through past with the previous family and everything like that, a lot of the pastures have been run down, and they had grown predominantly mostly cool season grasses, so I really don't have a lot of warm season stuff in, so that's kind of the downside to a lot of cool season. You have to get on it sooner and get it ate down and let the warm seasons come in, so it's a lot of moving earlier on in the spring a guy tries to, and hope that we get some warm seasons come back. I have a few pastures that are warm season. I'm still rather in my infancy on this, and I don't really have all my grasses down very well, but I mean, we do get some Kentucky blue stem as our warm season and whatnot, but you know, we got a lot of brome, intermediate brome and stuff like that. You just have to hit that harder fast, and sometimes we get it done and sometimes we don't.
Are you doing anything to see some of the grasses you prefer increase and some of the grasses you don't desire decrease? Are you doing anything like that?
We've been tightening up the paddock some and trying to get the cattle to stomp that down, not necessarily if they eat it, just to get it. It's kind of, we're trying it. We got some way smaller paddocks and running a lot higher stock density rates on them to try and get it done, and I'm only going into my third year, so we're starting to see a little bit, but I'm hoping we see more as we progress.
What are you talking about when you're talking stock density as far as size of paddocks? How big are these paddocks that you're talking about where you're trying to stomp down some of these different species?
Well, my first little paddock grazing scenario, we took 320 acres and cut it up into 10 paddocks, so that equaled out to about 38 acres, and we threw 150 pairs in there. And the cows average about 1,200, 1,350 pounds and about an 80-pound calf. I mean, the stock density rate still isn't super high, but they could usually pretty easily cover that down in about a 4 to 5 day period in the spring. Now we've upped it to 225 head on the same deal, just trying to, if anything, stomp that stuff down if they necessarily don't eat it. And I think we could go even higher, but then we'd be moving a lot more. And I still farm a fair amount of acres, so in the springtime that either relies on my wife to move them, or we have to run them on a little bit bigger deal so we don't have to try and move every single day. When planting's done and whatnot, the moving every couple days isn't such a big deal as some people would think it would be. So.
Well, and that's when you're looking at cutting hay out altogether, some of those things you've got time for. If you're not making hay or you're not trying to track hay down, you've got
exactly
time for those things.
And let's face it, paying equipment, just like farming equipment, is getting rather expensive anymore. It costs a lot more per bale to run that equipment now. So that was what I was looking at. We put up a lot of hay over the years. I remember when I was younger, if we didn't put up 10,000 bales of hay a year, we were maybe going to be a little short, and we were always trying to raise a surplus. Well, shoot, now I'm down to, this last year alone, I only put up about 1,000 bales.
What is that hay ground? Is that hay ground now feeding cows? Is the same ground that you were putting up these bales on? Are you grazing it now? Is that is that what you're doing?
Yep, that is the plan. A lot of it's getting turned into, and this is how I'm trying to get the warm season back on them quicker, is we're cutting them earlier in the year, so we're cutting the cool season off, letting the warm season grow, and then we'll graze the cows on it over the winter months, along with, there's usually some crop ground next to them, and we're planting a cover crop mix into that to kind of help balance the cattle's diet. I've noticed we've always grazed the cattle on aftermath crop residue, whether it's corn stalks, wheat, oats, milo, whatever. So it's all, and we've had guys always say, well, we got to have protein tubs out on corn stalks. And I'm like, we've never had the desire to run protein tubs or needed to, but our cows have also, they could run on corn stalks, but then there was 40 acres of grass or 40 acres of something else in that same area they were grazing. So they could kind of, I feel they were balancing their own diet.
Right, yeah.
Saying not needing it.
What have been have you noticed any benefits thus far? How far are you into this journey, I guess? Is this year two or the start of year three?
This will be going into year three. We basically got to hit the reset button on the 365. The plan was, and as you've seen on my Twitter at the Gray Situation, my plan was is to have all the hay and equipment gone by year 2020.
Okay.
So I wanted to give myself, you know, about 4 or 5 years to say, well, yep, I just don't need that equipment anymore. If I do it, I'd almost rather buy hay and bring the nutrients into my farm and ranch operation than harvest them off my own or let the cattle do it naturally. So, I mean, and kind of the contingency plan as time goes on, I'm thinking I'm going to probably purchase about 400 to 500 bales of hay a year. Whether I use them or not, I guess, is going to be the almighty question. So,
well, you know, if you sell one of those tractors, you can build a pretty nice shed and keep that hay nice for a while. So,
well, and that has crossed my mind to actually build a couple hoop-type buildings just to store that hay in, and then when we do have to use it, we pull that out, and then we just replace what we need the following year, the following season, when the hay prices are cheap. Jim actually touches on this in his book, and this is kind of what got me thinking about it. He says you buy the hay in the season when everyone has it and it's abundant and the price is lower, and you take note of your resource about 3/4 of the way through the fall and go, well, do I need all this hay or not? Well, as other guys are getting shorter, that's when you turn around and sell yours if you don't need it. And well, quite honestly, you could probably maybe make a profit on it.
Yep. You know, kind of like the marketing for cattle, you know, the buy it when it's low and I sell it when it's high. If I've got overvalued hay in my shed, I can live without it, get rid of it. But you know, the other thing that brought to my mind was Jim Falstick. was my guest on episode 16 and was kind of my introduction to the South Coast Grassland Coalition and some of the guys that I've been interviewing for them. And he talked about that they try to keep a year's worth of hay on the place or in the shed, and he's got some hay in there that's seven to ten years old. But it's been in the shed since it was baled in or brought in on a truck. And so they're not too worried about the quality of it because it's been there. And if anything, it's just going to be a supplement when they do use it. It's not going to be the main nutrient for those cattle. They're just going to try and get them by on this paddock if there isn't as much stockpiled forage as they thought there would be.
Sure. Well, and that's kind of why I've tried to implement a lot of the crop ground, and now, like, on a lot of the wheat stubble and oat stubble and things like that we take off in the middle of the year, I try to plant a cover crop blend kind of tailored towards grazing for that fall and hopes to run the cattle on that. I mean, a lot of them fields are fairly decent size and don't lend very well to a polywire breakdown, but the ones I do, we have tried to break them down with a polywire, but it doesn't always happen. Unfortunately, like this last year going into the drought, we ended up overgrazing probably some of that ground, which I don't know, I'll see if it hurts my following year's crop, but I haven't seen it when we haven't had a cover crop out there hurt anything. So
what kind of benefits have you been noticing to these paddocks and then also to your crop ground? How's that looking?
The crop ground, a lot better water retention, especially when we started getting dry. I made a lot of notes last year in the drought. I know a lot of guys complained about it. I was probably one of the few people semi-excited about it because I was taking the opportunity to learn something. I mean, nothing like a drought makes you realize what your system is doing, how well you're building it, because you know where your resiliency is at. I had ground that with great cover in August when we're barely getting any rain, it still had a great corn crop at the end of the fall for the area. I was just completely shocked on it. But then I had two other fields, lower residue. Them fields got chopped for silage. They barely made 80 bushel, according to the adjuster, so we chopped them for silage. The field that I had high residue on and some cover crop years behind it, it made 145. And I sat down with NRCS and we kind of figured it up. And for my growing season, I had 9 inches of rain on that field.
Nice. Yeah.
So I made a lot of bushels per inch of water. And I know Gabe Brown talks a lot about that too. I've listened to Gabe Brown talk and Rick Bieber from Trail City. And I became a member of the Grassland Coalition here. Actually, kind of when I started this journey, that's how I hit Jim and listened to him talk. And there's guys in the coalition that have been doing some of this stuff way longer than I have. So I've been kind of taking pointers from them and calling, and a lot of them guys have been great to visit with on it too. And I'm taking it, I'm a little different level than a lot of the guys that are in the Grasslands Coalition that I've talked to. A lot of them guys are all grass. You know, they really don't have crop ground, so they're just focusing on the cows and the rotational grazing and everything. Well, me, I'm still trying to farm, and I've been integrating the crop ground into the grazing deal too, kind of like my father and his father had done in the past, except I feel I'm taking it to the next level by doing the cover crops and trying to leave more residue out there for in case we do hit another drought situation. I hope that I can at least still grow a decent crop and make some money in that tough year versus having to rely on the crop insurance check and a government program.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, you never know when those things are going to be slow in coming or whatever the case might be. So it's always good to be able to operate as much without them as possible, I think. And that's my humble opinion.
Well, and I love the fact that they've got the programs and they're willing to help us out. I know, for instance, last year, you know, we hit D3 drought in this area for 3 weeks, they kicked in a deal to allow us some money to, was supposed to purchase hay to feed our livestock. And I looked at the amount and I went, well, this is nice and all, but this wouldn't feed my group of cows for much more than 3-4 weeks. So I don't see how this was really a big help. I guess it helped pay some other bills and whatnot. I put it towards rather than buying hay because I didn't need to buy hay. But
yeah,
I know for the guys that were needing it, I had neighbors that were in desperate need of it, and they'd already spent it, shoot, a month prior to, and I guess I can't fault them. You know, that's part of their management. I don't speak for what they want to do, so.
Yeah. It's that's what Dave Pratt said when he was on the podcast. It's always easier to manage your neighbor's ranch, right?
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and thank our sponsors, and then we'll be back for more with Todd Bozen. We're talking about Graze 365 here today on the Working Cows podcast. This is Clay Connery again on behalf of the High Plains Ranch Practicum. They're getting filled up on their classes, and I want to challenge somebody from South Dakota to be a part of that class if there isn't already a member of the class that's going to be from South Dakota. You may be thinking that's a long drive. Well, I can guarantee you that the High Plains Ranch Practicum is worth the drive. I can also recommend a very awesome Airbnb with 4 beers on tap included in the cost of the rental of the Airbnb. So hpranchpracticum.com, go check it out and register soon before they fill up. We're back with Todd Bozen. I do need to, I was remiss at the top of the show. I need to thank Todd for taking time. He's in his tractor. He's planting right now, and I appreciate him taking time to sit down with me. He's helping me out in a pinch. I've got a couple of episodes that are recorded that just weren't quite up to snuff on the audio quality, and we couldn't quite get them over the line as far as audio quality was concerned. So I called Todd last night on my way home, and he said, yep, I'll sit down with you. And he just happens to be sitting in his tractor. I'm sitting in my office where I usually record these episodes. So, Todd, thank you for being willing to step in here on short notice.
Sure, no problem.
And I appreciate you. We connected a while ago on Twitter, and just different things got in the way, and we were not able to get together, and so we're here now. So I did want to ask you about the time we had connected and started talking about sitting down for an episode. You were looking at going to no-till on the plains. Were you able to make it down there?
Yep, me and the wife sure do. It was our second year going to it. That Alan Savory is the main speaker and such there. So
can you tell me a little bit about that trip? What was that like?
It was rather interesting. It's always, you know, quite eye-opening to go to another part of the state and listen to and talk to other guys on how they're doing stuff. And, you know, you think you have it tough where you're at and things are just, especially like last year where we had the drought like we did, and there was guys in Kansas and Nebraska that experienced the drought. But the one thing I think I took away from that, and it still sticks to my mind real bright here now, there's guys in Kansas that still fallow a lot. You know, they'll fallow a year, plant wheat, chemical fallow, whatever. And they're talking about they get like 25 inches of annual rainfall a year, and they're fallowing. And I sat there and I scratched my head and I go, why? And if you look in the books, my county is anywhere from 18 to 22 inches of annual rainfall, and we produce a crop every year.
Right.
So that was rather eye-opening on that, but guys thought that 22 inches of rain and plus was not enough to be able to grow a crop every year of some sort. So.
Yeah. Was there any discussion there at No-Till on the Plains? Were they kind of on your side that keeping that root in the soil is kind of the best thing for it, and you want to, you know, keep on with crops every year or
yep.
You know, living roots in the soil, honestly.
Yes, and I, you know, that's kind of why I enjoy going to that. You listen to a lot of people. There's Jimmy Emmons was there talking, several other producers that have been working towards that in, like, the Oklahoma, Kansas area and such. Dexter Axton is from Canada, and he's actually having a field day coming up here. I'd have to look on Twitter again to know for sure when it was, but they got a whopping 7 inches of rain last year, I think, for a total.
Hmm.
and they still manage to produce a crop, but some of his systems, he composts, and they do a lot of intercropping, they call it. They're raising two crops at one time, and I've been kind of trying to experiment with that here a little bit, and some of the relay cropping I heard about in No-Till on the Plains, because, well, as a lot of the other farmers in the area would know and across the U.S., that margins are getting a lot tighter on this, so what are we trying to do to make a little bit more money per acre? Well, what if we could grow two different crops in the same season on the same acre? And that's kind of what the relay cropping is. You plant your winter wheat or rye or such as that in the fall in like a twin row scenario, and then you come back in the spring and plant soybeans in between them rows shortly before flag leaf. And when harvest comes on the wheat, you go out and you harvest the wheat. Well, now you've got soybeans underneath that, and then you come and take soybeans off that fall.
Hmm.
I visited with a gal from France, which unfortunately her name escapes me now. I do follow her on Twitter too. But they actually do sorghum in this scenario over there. They've been doing it over in Europe for quite a few years now, so I've been tempted to do it. I have unfortunately not gotten my relay planting done. I did do the twin row wheat last fall, but unfortunately dryness is kind of rearing its ugly head, and I've been a little hesitant to go out and try and plant anything between that wheat because I've dug down and the ground is rather dry in between them twin rows. So I'm going to have to force myself to do it just like I did last year with planting cover crops when it was dry. I'm just going to have to close my eyes and do it and have faith, I guess.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Where do the cows come into all this as far as that crop ground? You said you graze aftermath, you graze the cover crops. Was there any discussion at No-Till on the Plains about that or anything?
Oh, yes, there's a lot of the keys they're talking about with No-Till and the cover crops is integrating livestock and having it a part of it, because just something with adding that biological to the system to process it, the manure on the ground, is supposed to get your microbiology going even faster.
Yep.
Just for the simple fact of you're processing the nutrients and everything like that. I don't know whether to say I can say I have seen a big advantage or disadvantage to it. We've always had cattle on the crop ground in our operation. I know there's a lot of guys that it's a big red letter or they don't want to see cattle on their crop ground, and I've seen why. You drive through the country sometimes and guys leave cattle on crop ground at inopportune times. When there's a thawing event, they need to be removed. You don't want to leave them out there. If there's a high rain event, they need to come off too. You can't just leave them. Some of the guys running cattle anymore, and I'm sorry if I offend any of you guys, they seem to be an afterthought. We turn them out on the pasture and we let them be. And I can say when I was younger and everything like that, we were just as guilty of it. We turn the cows out the pasture and maybe see them once a week for their check and salt mineral, and maybe 3 to 4 months we would move them to a different pasture maybe, or sometimes they'd stay in that same pasture the whole summer. I mean, it worked and it got us by, but increasing profitability and all, I don't think it was there at that point, but things didn't cost quite as much then either, and I wasn't in charge, so I didn't know what the books were like then. So.
It's good stuff. I really appreciate that. All that is right in line with what we're here to do on the Working Cows podcast, you know, just to challenge people with paradigm-challenging practices, give them something out of the box to think about, and I think you're right there. What's the future of this Graze 365 project look like? What do you see coming down and some of the ways that you can adjust and adapt and some of those things? What does that look like for you?
Well, the biggest resource I think anyone has, and especially when it comes to rotational grazing, it's easy to break paddocks down or break your pastures down. Your next biggest thing is water. How do I water them cattle when I break these down? Unfortunately, I'm rather fortunate. A lot of my pasture ground has a free-flowing creek through it.
Mm.
So breaking them pastures down has been a little bit easier. We have a creek at one end of them. We can cut it down and let them do that. And then I've been working on, installing water in a lot of the other areas, and that realistically is probably the biggest expense and the challenge, but I've tried some above ground pipe and that works pretty well. The biggest hiccup with that is you definitely do not want your cattle grazing over top of the line until you are done grazing your system, because the water will get rather hot. I didn't believe people when they told me that, but it's about like having a hot tub when it fills that cattle water. So, yeah. I'm actually looking at just sub-burying a lot of my line about a foot and a half to 2 foot in the ground just to get it away from the walking and driving traffic. And a lot of these paddocks are usually used in the summer. My cattle spend most of the winter time out on aftermath grazing, and there's a few pastures that have had some warm season grass in it that work out well for that. So, and then have a water source, a Cobet fountain of some sort to keep water there. We do have to occasionally chop maybe some ice on a dugout or whatever. But I would tell a lot of the guys, don't be scared to take one pasture and just break it down, you know, the best way you can. I mean, high tensile wire and steel posts and clips per foot is rather cheap, and that's all I did. I mean, a lot of my divides are just a single high tensile wire with steel posts and a clip. I know fiberglass posts are probably easier, but when I figured the cost and getting into it for the first time, I went, what if I don't like this system? What if I need to put other fence in? I don't want all them fiberglass posts because, well, what am I going to do with them?
Yeah, they're good for one thing.
Yeah, if I have steel posts, I can at least take that clip off and throw it away and use that steel in a four barbed wire fence somewhere, you know, that's it.
Yep.
But it was amazing how well them cattle got to responding, because that's what I did. I took that 320 acres and I broke it down into 10 paddocks, and a lot of it had creek in it, a couple supplement water sources, and that's what I started, and I put it right next to my house, so I drove by it every day.
Mm.
So that way I basically forced myself to monitor it all the time, and once I kind of got to seeing how it worked and everything, and pretty soon the cattle got to working and moving a lot easier. Pretty much they started to learn, just like, you know, I was a skeptic too. Guys like, oh, yeah, they move real easy, and I'm like, yeah, I can't see that, but they do. Once they learn the system and learn how you run them through it, they, after about 3 to 4 moves, cows that you thought were rather ornery are rather tame and get to moving. They're expecting it. They see you come out and they're ready to move, and they don't push them hot wires that hard because they're always getting to fresh grass every so many days. So they just don't even push so much on the regular barbed wire fence. I've noticed the perimeter fence that are barbed wire, once they get to doing this, they don't even reach through that near as much because they go, why? Why do I want to hurt my neck when I know I'm going to get moved in a few hours or in a few days or something?
Sure. Yeah, you mentioned that last night when we were talking on the phone, that you had some disposition changes from pre-calving to post-calving and some of those things.
Yep.
And a lot of that had to do with the fact that now in this system you're handling them more. Is that right?
Sure. Yep. Yep, you're handling them more. And I feel the cattle just feel a little bit more ease. We moved calving too. We used to calve in March, and I've moved it to the end of April, 1st of May with the first group that we did this on, and now they're all going that way. But I think it comes down to the nature and the fact of security. That cow will have their calf out in the grass and feel it's safe because there's grass up around it. They feel the predator is not going to see their young. But in a yard situation where all the grass is beat down or there is no grass, they were a little snottier with us. We ran into that because where we're having to feed this winter, cows that didn't give us one lick of trouble last spring, all of a sudden were kind of making us question whether we wanted to be in the yard with them or not. So
that's really interesting. Yeah, good stuff. Thank you for your time today, Todd.
Sure.
We can go on and on, I think, but I really appreciate it. Anything, any resources you want to recommend to people that are looking and getting started in this?
Jim Gresh's book, Kicking the Hay Habit, that's kind of where I got my start at. I definitely recommend them to check out the Grassland Coalition. there's guys there that will amaze you. You'll sit there and your head will spin because you didn't think you could do stuff like that. And there's guys that have been doing it. And some guys are even closer to you than you probably think.
Yeah.
Is what surprised me more than anything. Social media, Twitter, I mean, if you type in, you know, Graves365, you'll bring up my stuff. And there's several other guys that are doing it. I follow a lot of guys from Canada because they have a tougher situation than we do, and they're doing bale grazing and swath grazing, and that's kind of the stuff I'm looking towards. Maybe not so much the bale grazing, but maybe the swath grazing. I would probably keep a swather around and go out and swath like sorghum finan or some late season hay and bring it into a big windrow and run a polywire across that as far as a winter grazing program goes, if I'm thinking we're going to be maybe in a little deeper snow situation, if I'm going to try to push that resource. I've got plans to, I got a 20-acre patch that I actually plan to try and swath graze this next winter.
Cool.
Just to see how it works.
I'd love to get you back on maybe next spring or something. We'll see. Maybe before then too. But just to talk about how this process is going and talk about, you know, how the swath grazing went and different things like that. So I'd love to keep you updated. And we'll link to all those things that you just mentioned in the show notes page, workingcows.net/32. And we will also link to Todd's social media accounts there so you can jump on and follow him and see how that process is going for yourself. But I appreciate your time today, and I'd look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Sure. No, thank you very much, Clay. Appreciate it.
Really good stuff there with Todd, just about the challenges and the successes and the benefits and the future of his Graze 365 project. I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As of right now, I don't know where we're going next week, but I'm sure we will find someone to chat with for the Working Cows podcast, episode 33, coming out next week, and we'll see you then.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.